Very good to see each of you this morning. Hope that you all benefit from our worship together. I know that our Lord is pleased when we worship Him in the way that He has taught. And I believe that we've done that this morning. We'll continue with the study of His Word now. Our study of Mark's Gospel brings us to Mark chapter 9, verse 14 this morning. And the reading is going to be primarily about faith and what the lack of faith does to the Lord's disciples. And so if you want to turn and read along with me, or I'll have the scripture up on the screen that we're looking at, let's read together from chapter 9, verse 14 through verse 29. And when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them, and scribes disputing with them. Immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed, and running to him, greeted him. And he asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Then one of the crowd answered and said, "Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not." He answered him and said, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." Then they brought him to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. So he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "Deaf and dumb spirit, I command you to come out of him and enter him no more." Then the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him. And he became as one dead, so that many said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" So he said to them, "This kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting." This is an account of a notable miracle which Jesus performed, though basically by now the Lord in his personal ministry is through performing miracles. He's about to make the trek to Judea, for he has an appointed time in Jerusalem. So the verses that we have read are about a miracle, but the reading is mainly a lesson about faith, how important it is, and what the deficiency of it will do. We know the Lord's disciples and apostles pretty well by now. We know that they're often characterized by misunderstanding, shallow faith. In fact, if you'll remember back in chapter 8, verse 14, the Lord asked them, "Do you not see or understand? Do you have a dull heart? Having eyes, do you not see?" And finally back there, he asked them, "How is it that you do not understand?" They needed to understand a lot of things. And here where we have read, faith is the issue. The disciples were definitely a work in progress. They've been with Jesus for roughly 2.5 years. They had heard all that he had taught. They had seen the miracles that he had done. The power of Jesus was always in their midst. But in this incident, there's a lesson on the power of faith that they really need to learn. Because in this incident, there happened to be a time when Jesus was not there, and their faith was weak. We're entering into a period here in Mark's Gospel in which Jesus begins to move toward Jerusalem, where he will die and rise again, and ascend. From this point in Mark's gospel, and it's a final segment now of only a few months, Mark's focus is on the lessons taught to the disciples, the Lord's instruction on issues that were critical for their training as his apostles if they were to carry on when he was gone. So what we're going to find from here to the beginning of chapter 11 and verse 1, when he enters Jerusalem for the final week of his life, is one lesson after another on what the disciples need to grasp before he is gone. The lessons will be interjected by reminders that he must go to the cross. The first lesson is the one before us. It's a lesson of faith, the power of faith. That's going to be followed by a lesson on humility. And then there's a lesson on offenses. And there's a lesson on the seriousness of sin. And then a lesson on marriage and divorce. Another on the place of children in the kingdom. And then a lesson on earthly riches. And then a lesson on true wealth. And then a lesson on leadership and sacrificial service. And then in chapter 10, verses 46 to 52, the final lesson will be again on faith. So I've just given you the coming sermons for the next several weeks or months. But today's lesson is the lesson on faith. Let's get our bearing, our context now, because it's been a while since we were last in Mark's gospel. Notice that verse 14 says, "And when he came to the disciples," do you remember where he's been? He's been on the mountain, probably Mount Hermon, which towered over Caesarea Philippi, north of Galilee, with only three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John. The Lord took them up there for him to be transfigured before the three. And they saw Moses and Elijah appear before their eyes. Moses and Elijah were talking with Jesus about his upcoming death. And on the way down from the mount, they asked Jesus about the fact that Elijah was to come before the Messiah came. And Jesus taught them that Elijah indeed had already come. He had come in the person of John the Baptist, who was like Elijah in both his person and his ministry. So now here in chapter 9 and verse 14, they have come down to where the other nine apostles are, and possibly other disciples with them, and they have come into a great commotion that is taking place. A large multitude is gathered, people who most likely have come seeking Jesus, who have probably either heard that he was there, or they've seen his disciples and assumed that he must be there. So they have come expecting Jesus, but Jesus was not there. He was up on the mountain with the three. And Jesus with the three has come into their midst. Verse 14 says that when they arrived, there was a large crowd around the disciples, and there are scribes there who are arguing or disputing with his disciples, the nine who had been left at the base of the mountain. The multitude has come seeking Jesus, either to see or hear or to learn or to be helped in some way. The scribes have come, of course, with a different purpose, as they always did. They've come to protect their turf, or at least to hinder, if not destroy, the influence and the work of Jesus. So this large crowd has been drawn by the anticipation of Jesus, the healer, the wonder worker. But when they came, they found that Jesus was not there. And they had been unable to find Jesus, but at least they had found most of the Lord's disciples, his apostles, who were evidently waiting for the return of their master. In this multitude was a father with a demoniac son. And since Jesus was not there, the father asked if the disciples could heal his son, cast the demon out of him. The disciples tried to do that, but they failed. And this opened up an avenue for the scribes to dispute with them, it would seem, about their inability to dispel this demon from this boy. Their humiliation and failure was an open door for the scribes to attack all the claims of Jesus. And of course, the father of this boy was hearing whatever attack they made, and I would strongly suspect that they were mocking the Lord's disciples. While all this was going on, suddenly, verse 15, Jesus appears. It says, immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed, and running to him, greeted him. That expression, greatly amazed, comes from a very strong word in the Greek. It's a word that means awestruck. And they might have been awestruck because they knew of his power and they'd come to see and now he was here. Or they may have been amazed at the timing of his appearance, that he showed up now. He's appeared at the very moment of the defeat of his apostles, and as they're being so vilified by these scribes for their pitiful lack of power. Now Jesus speaks. Verse 16 says, and he asked the scribes, what are you discussing with them? That word discussing is questioning in the American Standard Version. That's a word that's often used to describe confrontations with religious leaders. So if you're reading in the ESV or the NIV, it better translates, I think, the original word this way. What are you arguing with them about? The scribes were arguing with his disciples. Jesus says, what's this argument about? Well, the scribes don't answer his question. The disciples don't answer the question either because they're probably too embarrassed to answer it. And so it seems there could well have been a rather painful silence after Jesus asked this challenging question. But then one of the multitude answers, verse 17. Then one of the crowd answered and said, teacher, I brought you my son. You see from that he was expecting Jesus to be there, but Jesus wasn't. I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out. But they could not. The father explained to Jesus how the whole argument had come about. His original intent was to bring his son, to Jesus. And when he found that Jesus was not there, as kind of a second thought, he appealed to the apostles who were there. His son was terribly possessed by a demon. We have seen those possessed by demons already in Mark's gospel. And Jesus always had power over them, power to expel them from people. Demons are spirit beings, evil spirits who in New Testament times took up residence in people. And the people whom they possessed were controlled by the demon. And the demon had caused this boy at the end of verse 17 to be mute. Not only mute, but we find out later in the account, it caused him to be deaf. The boy could not hear and he could not speak. And it had nothing to do with an illness, nothing to do with a physical problem. It had to do with demonic control. The control of the demon had brought this condition upon him. There may also have been damage to the brain to this boy. The demon would seize him and throw him down to the ground. So this is not a genetic disorder. It's not a childhood disease. When the demon seized him, the boy would scream, Luke says in his account. Matthew says that he was moonstruck. It's a word that's translated lunatic in some of the versions. But this was all caused by the demon. The demon is battering this man's son, throwing him to the ground, throwing him into convulsions. And the boy foams at the mouth and begins rolling around, as it says later, and then he grinds his teeth and stiffens out. Luke 9 in verse 39 uses the verb centurbon, which means to crush or to shatter or to maul. That's what this demon was doing to this boy. It's a terrible condition. And the father is desperate to have him healed. Now listen to what the father says to Jesus at the middle of verse 18. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not. Luke says in his account that the father implored, he begged them, but they still could not do it. Well, this is strange. Because look at what we're told back in Matthew, in Mark chapter 6 and verse 7. It's speaking of the apostles, and it says, "And he called the 12 to himself and began to send them out two by two and gave them power over unclean spirits." Unclean spirits is another term for demons. Did the 12 demonstrate that power? Verse 13 of the same chapter says this, "And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them." Jesus had delegated his power to them to cast out demons, and they had done it. So what's going on here? Why do they now fail? Well, it seems to me that Jesus answers that question in verse 19 when he says, "O faithless generation." Faithless means lacking in faith. The New American Standard translates it, "O unbelieving generation." And that's what it says in the footnote of the New King James from which I read. When Jesus says, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you?" it's not immediately clear whom he is addressing at this point. There are some commentators who seem to think that Jesus is addressing the crowd here and not the disciples. It seems to me from the context that Jesus is more likely addressing the disciples, especially the 9 disciples who have so dismally failed in their attempt to heal this boy. Now, Jesus had called the nation of Israel back in chapter 8, verse 38, an adulterous and sinful generation. Here it seems that he's talking to his disciples. So maybe he's saying, in their lack of faith, the disciples are being like the faithless generation around them. Jesus has said to these disciples on more than one occasion, "O you of little faith." And in Matthew's account of this morning's event, this same event, when the disciples asked why they could not cast out the demon, he said to them, "Because of your unbelief." Matthew 17 and verse 20. So I take this statement of the Lord in verse 19 to mean to be a rebuke of the apostles who were not able to cast out the demon. And the Lord in his frustration says of them, "O faithless, unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you?" The newer versions say, "How long shall I put up with you?" And I picture Jesus saying what we read next like this, "Bring him to me." Or maybe, "Bring him to me. You brought him to my disciples. Now bring him to me." And as some people begin toward Jesus with the boy, the demon begins to go into action. He shows a demonic display of his evil power. You know, the demons always recognize Jesus. They realized and confessed who he was, the Son of God. And they knew that they must obey him. And so it is with this demon. Verse 20 says, "And when he," the demon, "saw him," Jesus, "immediately the spirit convulsed him," the boy, "and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth." Well, that certainly confirmed what the father had just told Jesus about the son's condition, didn't it? Verse 21 says this of Jesus, "So he asked his father, 'How long has this been happening to him?'" Why do you suppose Jesus asked that question? Does he need information? No, Jesus knows everything. What's the reason for this question? Well, we're not told, so we can't know for sure. That Jesus did not ask for information, I believe we can know for sure, so it was for some other purpose. And the father answered his question from childhood. Now, the question may have been for a trial and a strengthening of the father's faith, or it may have been asked for the purpose of the crowd so that all would know the extreme nature of this case. From childhood, the present age of the boy is not given. The father answering in verse 21 continued describing his son's pitiful condition in verse 22. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. This monster of a demon is trying to kill his son. The boy constantly faced the imminent danger of destruction. Why else would this demon convulse the boy and slam him into a fire? In that day, there were open fires everywhere. That's what the way they cooked. That's the way they heated everything. And on other occasions, the demon would slam him into the water. There were wells everywhere, the source of their water, and there were pools everywhere. And apparently the father spent a great deal of his time trying to keep his son from being killed by this demon, rescuing the boy out of wells and pools and fires. What a way to live your life. But there must have now been in the father's heart a glimmer of hope now that Jesus was talking to him in such a sympathetic manner. And then the father says this in verse 22. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Other translations say, but if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can. That's a pretty weak statement of faith, isn't it? I mean, earlier in Mark's gospel, we have people who come to Jesus saying, will you heal? Are you willing? This father's not saying, will you? Seems he's convinced that Jesus may be willing with the sympathy that he is showing. But what he's not sure about is, can you? Can you do something about this demon who's terrorizing my son? Can you cast him out? If you can do anything, please have pity on us and help us. Now, before you become too critical of this father, I would just remind you of a thing or two. He had some faith in Jesus. He had come seeking him, hadn't he? He believed Jesus might cast the demon out of his little boy. But when he got to where he thought Jesus might be, he found Jesus' disciples. He told Jesus back in verse 18, I spoke to your disciples that they should cast it out, but they could not. We've seen that Jesus' disciples had been able to cast out demons in earlier times, but this time they could not. And that seems to be what the argument with the scribes was all about. The father, and we would assume the scribes, thus have witnessed the failure of the 9 disciples. So now the father expresses some doubt in Jesus' power to expel this demon. I think I can understand that to some degree. Nevertheless, Jesus responds in verse 23 by saying, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Now, there is another way to capture the original there, and most of the newer translations have done just that. And even the New King James, from which I read, has done so in a footnote. It has Jesus saying this, if you can. And that's not a question, it's an explanation. An exclamation. Some of the newer versions do put a question mark there, but if you read it with a question mark, it should read like this. If you can. Another way to say that could be, if you can, are you serious? It's an exclamation of surprise by the Lord. How can that even be in question? And then Jesus gives the lesson. All things are possible to him who believes. The challenge here is not Jesus' challenge. It's not a challenge as to whether the Lord can do the miracle. The challenge is to the faith of the man who is asking. And incidentally, though maybe not so incidental, the challenge is to Jesus' disciples, because Jesus is soon going to be gone and the disciples are not going to have him around. The power will be available to them. That's what he says in John 14 in the upper room. He who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also. But he also says to them there, if you ask anything in my name, I will do it. The disciples needed to have faith in him even when he was gone. Now, this statement is an extraordinarily abused text in the religious world. All things are possible to him who believes. Some interpret this passage in an absurd way to say that if I had enough faith, I could wake up tomorrow morning and have $10,000 in my bank account. Of course, I'll need to send a little money to the one preaching that message first before that happens. But Jesus said that to the Father in our text, prefacing it with, "If you can," and evidently struck fear in the man when Jesus said it. The Father loved his Son, and he had been determined to find Jesus and to appeal to him for a miracle of healing. But Jesus is now chiding him for his lack of faith. What if he has now become the cause of Jesus to refuse him his request? Has his expression of doubt, the statement, "If you can," closed the door to hope for his son? Verse 24 says, "Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, 'Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief.'" He is desperate. Has he himself, by what he has said, closed the door? Remember, while all this is going on, his son is writhing on the ground, foaming at the mouth. "Oh, Lord, I do believe. Please help my unbelief." There's an honest man. "Lord, I believe in you and I believe in your power, but I also have doubts and fears and I admit it." Is that enough? How much faith do you have to have? I can certainly identify with that and I expect that you can. Praise be to God. The Lord does not expect perfect faith, although he is certainly worthy of it. All he is ever going to get out of any one of us is imperfect faith. Even believers believe sometimes with a measure of doubt mixed in. "Lord, I do believe. Please help my unbelief." This man's faith was enough. In Matthew's account of this event, he adds something that Jesus said, that if one's faith was only as large as a tiny mustard seed, it would be enough to accomplish great things. While Jesus was having this conversation, the crowd starts to swell. And verse 25 says, "When Jesus saw that the people were coming to him, when Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, 'Deaf and dumb spirit, I command you to come out of him and enter him no more.'" This demon is going to have to obey, and he knows it. But there is a final protest here by the demon, a vicious protest in verse 26. It says, "Then the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many said, 'He is dead.'" The boy lies limp, exhausted by the convulsions, so much like a corpse that most of them thought he was dead. But no, verse 27 says, "Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose." Luke adds this in his account, "Jesus gave him back to his father." What a tender, magnificent, wonderful scene. But now here's the lesson to be learned from all of this. Verse 28. "And when he had come into the house, his disciples asked him, 'Why could we not cast it out?'" Probably not far away was a village in which some disciples lived, and the apostles waited to question Jesus in private, probably because to have asked them in public would have added to their humiliation and embarrassment. If there was something to be learned from this experience, at least they were of a mind to learn it. We have no indication these disciples had ever failed before, but apparently vital faith had been sorely lacking this time when they attempted to cast out the demon. Matthew has Jesus answering them when they ask, "How were we unable to cast it out?" He said, "Because of your little faith." Had they attempted to do it merely on their own? Did they try to do it only by their own strength and power? Mark has Jesus saying in verse 29, "This kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting." Most of the newer translations omit the words "and fasting" there, since it's missing in some of the manuscripts. "This kind can come out by nothing but prayer." A larger faith will always come to those who pray, because those who pray are depending on the Father. Those who seek to couple divine help to whatever they can do as humans. We have said that there is much more that we would like to know about demons, evil spirits, who were present in the time of Christ and the apostles. The expression "this kind" in verse 29 seems to suggest that this was a particularly vicious type of demon that maybe should have challenged the disciples to the utmost in prayer. They should have been very deeply in prayer in this situation, and apparently were not. In conclusion, let's learn our own lesson from what we have read this morning. We have our own challenges, challenges to our faith. We need to exercise our faith. And it doesn't have to be perfect faith. None of us has perfect faith. But we must maintain our faith, and we can even increase our faith. And we need to be doing that. How do we do that? Well, do you remember the stories in Luke chapter 11 and Luke chapter 18? The story in Luke 11 about the friend who came to his neighbor at midnight for bread, and the woman in chapter 18 who came to the judge asking him to avenge her of her adversary. They had challenges. And those parables are teaching the need for prayerful persistence before our Father. That's what disciples need to do. Show faith in our Father, faith enough to pray. And so if you're here this morning and you are not a disciple, you can become one by showing your faith in Jesus as the Son of God. You do that when you admit that you're a sinner and you come to Jesus for cleansing in His blood, which cleansing we received in baptism for the remission of our sins. And if you've never done that, why not do it today while we stand and sing our song?
Have thine own way.